hospitals proliferated. Between 1945 and 1960, nearly 1,000 new hospitals were launched nationwide. Between 1935 and 1952, the number of patients admitted more than doubled from 7 million to 17 million per year. And with the rise in medical care came the concomitant expectation of medical cure. As one student observed, when a doctor has to tell a patient that there is no specific remedy for his condition, the patient is apt to feel affronted or to wonder whether the doctor is keeping abreast of the times. In new and sanitized suburban towns, a young generation thus dreamed of cures, of a death-free, disease-free existence. Lulled by the idea of the durability of life, they threw themselves into consuming durables, boat-sized Studebakers, rayon leisure suits, televisions, radios, vacation homes, golf clubs, barbecue grills, washing machines. In Levittown, a sprawling suburban settlement built in a potato field on Long Island, a symbolic utopia. Illness now ranked third in a list of worries, falling behind finances and child-rearing. In fact, rearing children was becoming a national preoccupation at an unprecedented level. Fertility rose steadily. By 1957, a baby was being born every 7 seconds in America. The affluent society, as the economist John Galbraith described it, also imagined itself as eternally young, with an accompanying guarantee of eternal health, the invincible society. But of all diseases, cancer had refused to fall into step in this march of progress. If a tumor was strictly local, i.e., confined to a single organ or site so that it could be removed by a surgeon, the cancer stood a chance of being cured. Extirpations, as these procedures came to be called, were a legacy of the dramatic advances of 19th century surgery. A solitary malignant lump in the breast, say, could be removed via a radical mastectomy pioneered by the great surgeon William Halstead at Johns Hopkins in the 1890s. With the discovery of X-rays in the early 1900s, radiation could be used to kill tumor cells at local sites. But scientifically, cancer still remained a black box, a mysterious entity that was best cut away en bloc rather than treated by some deeper medical insight. To cure cancer, if it could be cured at all, doctors had only two strategies, excising the tumor surgically or incinerating it with radiation, a choice between the hot ray and the cold knife. In May 1937, almost exactly a decade before Farber began his experiments with chemicals, Fortune magazine published what it called a panoramic survey of cancer medicine. The report was far from comforting. The startling fact is that no new principle of treatment, whether for cure or prevention, has been introduced. The methods of treatment have become more efficient and more humane. Crude surgery without anesthesia or asepsis has been replaced by modern painless surgery, with its exquisite technical refinement. Biting caustics that ate into the flesh of past generations of cancer patients have been obsolesced by radiation with X-ray and radium. But the fact remains that the cancer cure still includes only two principles: the removal and destruction of diseased tissue, the former by surgery, the latter by X-rays. No other means have been proved. The Fortune article was titled "Cancer, the Great Darkness," and the darkness, the authors suggested, was as much political as medical. Cancer medicine was stuck in a rut not only because of the depth of medical mysteries that surrounded it, but because of the systematic neglect of cancer research. There are not over 24 funds in the U.S. devoted to fundamental cancer research. They range in capital from about $500 to about $2 million. But their aggregate capitalization is certainly not much more than $5 million. The public willingly spends a third of that sum in an afternoon to watch a major football game. The stagnation of research funds stood in stark contrast to the swift rise to prominence of the disease itself. Cancer had certainly been present and noticeable in 19th century America, but it had largely lurked in the shadow of vastly more common illnesses. In 1899, when Roswell Park, a well-known Buffalo surgeon, had argued that cancer would someday overtake smallpox, typhoid fever, and tuberculosis to become the leading cause of death in the nation, his remarks had been perceived as a rather startling prophecy, the hyperbolic speculations of a man who, after all, spent his days and nights operating on cancer. But by the end of the decade, Park's remarks were becoming less and less startling, and more prophetic by the day. Typhoid, aside from a few scattered outbreaks, was becoming increasingly rare. Smallpox was on the decline. By 1949, it would disappear from America altogether. Meanwhile, cancer was already outgrowing other diseases, ratcheting its way up the ladder of killers. Between 1900 and 1916, cancer-related mortality grew by 29.8%, edging out tuberculosis as a cause of death. By 1926, cancer had become the nation's second most common killer, just behind heart disease. Cancer, the Great Darkness, wasn't alone in building a case for a coordinated national response to cancer. In May that year, Life carried its own dispatch on cancer research, which conveyed the same sense of urgency. The New York Times published two reports on rising cancer rates in April and June. When cancer appeared in the pages of Time in July 1937, interest in what was called the cancer problem was like a fierce contagion in the media. Proposals to mount a systematic national response against cancer had risen and ebbed rhythmically in America since the early 1900s. In 1907, a group of cancer surgeons had congregated at the New Willard Hotel in Washington to create an organization to lobby Congress for more funds for cancer research. By 1910, this organization, the American Association for Cancer Research, had convinced President Taft to propose to Congress a national laboratory dedicated to cancer research. But despite initial interest in the plan, the efforts had stalled in Washington after a few fitful attempts, largely because of a lack of political support. In the late 1920s, a decade after Taft's proposal had been tabled, cancer research found a new and unexpected champion, Matthew Neely, a dogged and ebullient former lawyer from Fairmont, West Virginia, serving his first term in the Senate. Although Neely had relatively little experience in the politics of science, he had noted the marked increase in cancer mortality in the previous decade, from 70,000 men and women in 1911 to 115,000 in 1927. Neely asked Congress to advertise a reward of $5 million for any information leading to the arrest of human cancer. It was a lowbrow strategy, the scientific equivalent of hanging a mugshot in a sheriff's office, and it generated a reflexively lowbrow response. Within a few weeks, Neely's office in Washington was flooded with thousands of letters from quacks and faith healers purporting every conceivable remedy for cancer: rubs, tonics, ointments, anointed handkerchiefs, salves, and blessed water. Congress, exasperated with the response, finally authorized $50,000 for Neely's cancer control bill, almost comically cutting its budget back to just 1% of the requested amount. In 1937, the indefatigable Neely, re-elected to the Senate, launched yet another effort to launch a national attack on cancer, this time jointly with Senator Homer Bone and Representative Warren Magnuson. By now, cancer had considerably magnified in the public eye. The Fortune and Time articles had fanned anxiety and discontent, and politicians were eager to demonstrate a concrete response. In June, a joint Senate-House conference was held to craft legislation to address the issue. After initial hearings, the bill raced through Congress and was passed unanimously by a joint session on July 23, 1937. 2 weeks later, on August 5th, President Roosevelt signed the National Cancer Institute Act. The act created a new scientific unit called the National Cancer Institute, NCI, designed to coordinate cancer research and education. In 1944, the NCI would become a subsidiary component of the National Institutes of Health, NIH. This foreshadowed the creation of other disease-focused institutes over the next decades. An advisory council of scientists for the institute was assembled from universities and hospitals. A state-of-the-art laboratory space with gleaming halls and conference rooms was built among leafy arcades and gardens in suburban Bethesda, a few miles from the nation's capital. The nation is marshaling its forces to conquer cancer, the greatest scourge that has ever assailed the human race, Senator Bone announced reassuringly while breaking ground for the building on October 3, 1938. After nearly two decades of largely fruitless efforts, a coordinated national response to cancer seemed to be on its way at last. All of this was a bold, brave step in the right direction, except for its timing. By the early winter of 1938, just months after the inauguration of the NCI campus in Bethesda, the battle against cancer was overshadowed by the tremors of a different kind of war. In November, Nazi troops embarked on a nationwide pogrom against Jews in Germany, forcing thousands into concentration camps. By late winter, military conflicts had broken out all over Asia and Europe, setting the stage for World War II. By 1939, those skirmishes had fully ignited, and in December 1941, America was drawn inextricably into the global conflagration. The war necessitated a dramatic reordering of priorities. The U.S. Marine Hospital in Baltimore, which the NCI had once hoped to convert into a clinical cancer center, was now swiftly reconfigured into a war hospital. Scientific research funding stagnated and was shunted into projects directly relevant to the war. Scientists, lobbyists, physicians, and surgeons fell off the public radar screen, mostly silent, as one researcher recalled, their contributions usually summarized in obituaries. An obituary might as well have been written for the National Cancer Institute. Congress's promised funds for a programmatic response to cancer never materialized, and the NCI languished in neglect. Outfitted with every modern facility imaginable in the 1940s, the Institute's sparkling campus turned into a scientific ghost town. One scientist jokingly called it a nice quiet place out here in the country. In those days, the author continued, it was pleasant to drowse under the large, sunny windows. In 1946 to 47, Neely and Senator Claude Pepper launched a third national cancer bill. This was defeated in Congress by a small margin in 1947. The social outcry about cancer also drifted into silence. After the brief flurry of attention in the press, cancer again became the great unmentionable, the whispered-about disease that no one spoke about publicly. In the early 1950s, Fanny Rosenau, a breast cancer survivor and cancer advocate, called the New York Times to post an advertisement for a support group for women with breast cancer. Rosenau was put through, puzzlingly, to the society editor of the newspaper. When she asked about placing her announcement, a long pause followed. I'm sorry, Ms. Rosenau, but the Times cannot publish the word breast or the word cancer in its pages. Perhaps, the editor continued, you could say there will be a meeting about diseases of the chest wall. Rosenau hung up, disgusted. When Farber entered the world of cancer in 1947, the public outcry of the past decade had dissipated. Cancer had again become a politically silent illness. In the airy wards of the Children's Hospital, doctors and patients fought their private battles against cancer. In the tunnels downstairs, Farber fought an even more private battle with his chemicals and experiments. This isolation was key to Farber's early success. insulated from the spotlights of public scrutiny. He worked on a small, obscure piece of the puzzle. Leukemia was an orphan disease, abandoned by internists who had no drugs to offer for it, and by surgeons who could not possibly operate on blood. Leukemia, as one physician put it, in some senses, had not even been cancer before World War II. The illness lived on the borderlands of illnesses, a pariah lurking between disciplines and departments, not unlike Farber himself. If leukemia belonged anywhere, it was within hematology, the study of normal blood. If a cure for it was to be found, Farber reasoned, it would be found by studying blood. If he could uncover how normal blood cells were generated, he might stumble backward into a way to block the growth of abnormal leukemic cells. His strategy, then, was to approach the disease from the normal to the abnormal, to confront cancer in reverse. Much of what Farber knew about normal blood he had learned from George Minot. A thin, balding aristocrat with pale, intense eyes, Minot ran a laboratory in a colonnaded brick-and-stone structure off Harrison Avenue in Boston, just a few miles down the road from the sprawling hospital complex on Longwood Avenue that included Children's Hospital. Like many hematologists at Harvard, Farber had trained briefly with Minot in the 1920s before joining the staff at Children's. Every decade has a unique hematological riddle, and for Minot's era, that riddle was pernicious anemia. Anemia is the deficiency of red blood cells, and its most common form arises from a lack of iron, a crucial nutrient used to build red blood cells. But pernicious anemia, the rare variant that Minot studied, was not caused by iron deficiency. Indeed, its name derives from its intransigence to the standard treatment of anemia with iron. By feeding patients increasingly macabre concoctions, half a pound of chicken liver, half-cooked hamburgers, raw hog stomach, and even once the regurgitated gastric juices of one of his students, spiced up with butter, lemon, and parsley, Minot and his team of researchers conclusively demonstrated in 1926 that pernicious anemia was caused by the lack of a critical micronutrient, a single molecule later identified as vitamin B12. In 1934, Minot and two of his colleagues won the Nobel Prize for this path-breaking work. Minot had shown that replacing a single molecule could restore the normalcy of blood in this complex hematological disease. Blood was an organ whose activity could be turned on and off by molecular switches. There was another form of nutritional anemia that Minot's group had not tackled, an anemia just as pernicious, although in the moral sense of that word. 8,000 miles away, in the cloth mills of Bombay, owned by English traders and managed by their cutthroat local middlemen, wages had been driven to such low levels that the mill workers lived in abject poverty, malnourished, and without medical care. When English physicians tested these mill workers in the 1920s to study the effects of this chronic malnutrition, they discovered that many of them, particularly women after childbirth, were severely anemic. This was yet another colonial fascination, to create the conditions of misery in a population, then subject it to social or medical experimentation. In 1928, a young English physician named Lucy Wills, freshly out of the London School of Medicine for Women, traveled on a grant to Bombay to study this anemia. Wills was an exotic among hematologists, an adventurous woman driven by a powerful curiosity about blood, willing to travel to a faraway country to solve a mysterious anemia on a whim. She knew of Minot's work, but unlike Minot's anemia, she found that the anemia in Bombay couldn't be reversed by Minot's concoctions or by vitamin B12. Astonishingly, she found she could cure it with Marmite, the dark, yeasty spread then popular among health fanatics in England and Australia. Wills could not determine the key chemical nutrient of Marmite. She called it the Wills factor. Wills factor turned out to be folic acid, or folate, a vitamin-like substance found in fruits and vegetables, and amply in Marmite. When cells divide, they need to make copies of DNA, the chemical that carries all the genetic information in a cell. Folic acid is a crucial building block for DNA and is thus vital for cell division. Since blood cells are produced by arguably the most fearsome rate of cell division in the human body, more than 300 billion cells a day, the genesis of blood is particularly dependent on folic acid. In its absence, in men and women starved of vegetables, as in Bombay, the production of new blood cells in the bone marrow halts. Millions of half-matured cells spew out, piling up like half-finished goods bottlenecked in an assembly line. The bone marrow becomes a dysfunctional mill, a malnourished biological factory oddly reminiscent of the cloth factories of Bombay. These links between vitamins, bone marrow, and normal blood kept Farber preoccupied in the early summer of 1946. In fact, his first clinical experiment, inspired by this very connection, turned into a horrific mistake. Lucy Wills had observed that folic acid, if administered to nutrient-deprived patients, could restore the normal genesis of blood. Farber wondered whether administering folic acid to children with leukemia might also restore normalcy to their blood. Following that tenuous trail, he obtained some synthetic folic acid, recruited a cohort of leukemic children, and started injecting folic acid into them. In the months that passed, Farber found that folic acid, far from stopping the progression of leukemia, actually accelerated it. In one patient, the white cell count nearly doubled. In another, the leukemia cells exploded into the bloodstream and sent fingerlings of malignant cells to infiltrate the skin. Farber stopped the experiment in a hurry. He called this phenomenon acceleration, evoking some dangerous object in free fall, careering toward its end. Pediatricians at Children's Hospital were furious about Farber's trial. The folate analogs had not just accelerated the leukemia, they had likely hastened the death of the children. But Farber was intrigued. If folic acid accelerated the leukemia cells in children, what if he could cut off its supply with some other drug, an antifolate? Could a chemical that blocked the growth of white blood cells stop leukemia? The observations of Minot and Wills began to fit into a foggy picture. If the bone marrow was a busy cellular factory to begin with, then a marrow occupied with leukemia was that factory in overdrive, a deranged manufacturing unit for cancer cells. Minot and Wills had turned the production lines of the bone marrow on by adding nutrients to the body. But could the malignant marrow be shut off by choking the supply of nutrients? Could the anemia of the mill workers in Bombay be recreated therapeutically in the medical units of Boston? In his long walks from his laboratory under Children's Hospital to his house on Amory Street in Brookline, Farber wondered relentlessly about such a drug. Dinner in the dark wood-paneled rooms of the house was usually a sparse, perfunctory affair. His wife, Norma, a musician and writer, talked about the opera and poetry. Sidney, of autopsies, trials, and patients. As he walked back to the hospital at night, Norma's piano tinkling practice scales in his wake, the prospect of an anti-cancer chemical haunted him. He imagined it palpably, visibly, with a fanatic's enthusiasm. But he didn't know what it was or what to call it. The word chemotherapy, in the sense we understand it today, had never been used for anti-cancer medicines. In New York in the 1910s, William B. Coley, James Ewing, and Ernest Codman had treated bone sarcomas with a mixture of bacterial toxins, the so-called Coley's toxin. Coley had observed occasional responses, but the unpredictable responses, likely caused by immune stimulation, never fully captured the attention of oncologists or surgeons. The elaborate armamentarium of antivitamins that Farmer had dreamed up so vividly in his fantasies did not exist. Farber's supply of folic acid for his disastrous first trial had come from the laboratory of an old friend, a chemist, Yella Pragada Subbarao, or Yella, as most of his colleagues called him. Yella was a pioneer in many ways, a physician turned cellular physiologist, a chemist who had accidentally wandered into biology. His scientific meanderings had been presaged by more desperate and adventuresome physical meanderings. He had arrived in Boston in 1923, penniless and unprepared, having finished his medical training in India and secured a scholarship for a diploma at the School of Tropical Health at Harvard. The weather in Boston, Yella discovered, was far from tropical. Unable to find a medical job in the frigid, stormy winter, he had no license to practice medicine in the United States, he started as a night porter at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, opening doors, changing sheets, and cleaning urinals. The proximity to medicine paid off. Subbarao made friends and connections at the hospital and switched to a day job as a researcher in the Division of Biochemistry. His initial project involved purifying molecules out of living cells, dissecting them chemically to determine their compositions, in essence, performing a biochemical autopsy on cells. The approach required more persistence than imagination, but it produced remarkable dividends. Subbarao purified a molecule called ATP, the source of energy in all living beings. ATP carries chemical energy in the cell. And another molecule called creatine, the energy carrier in muscle cells. Any one of these achievements should have been enough to guarantee him a professorship at Harvard. But Subbarao was a foreigner, a reclusive, nocturnal, heavily accented vegetarian who lived in a one-room apartment downtown, befriended only by other nocturnal recluses such as Farber. In 1940, denied tenure and recognition, Yella huffed off to join Lederle Labs, a pharmaceutical laboratory in upstate New York, owned by the American Cyanamid Corporation, where he had been asked to run a group on chemical synthesis. At Lederle, Yella Subbarao quickly reformulated his old strategy and focused on making synthetic versions of the natural chemicals that he had found within cells, hoping to use them as nutritional supplements. In the 1920s, another drug company, Eli Lilly, had made a fortune selling a concentrated form of B12, the missing nutrient in pernicious anemia. Subbarao decided to focus his attention on the other anemia, the neglected anemia of folate deficiency. But in 1946, after many failed attempts to extract the chemical from pigs' livers, he switched tactics and started to synthesize folic acid from scratch, with the help of a team of scientists including Harriet Kilty, a young chemist at Lederle. The chemical reactions to make folic acid brought a serendipitous bonus. Since the reactions had several intermediate steps, Subbarao and Kilty could create variants of folic acid through slight alterations in the recipe. These variants of folic acid, closely related molecular mimics, possessed counterintuitive properties. Enzymes and receptors in cells typically work by recognizing molecules using their chemical structure. But a decoy molecular structure, one that nearly mimics the natural molecule, can bind to the receptor or enzyme and block its action, like a false key jamming a lock. Some of Yella's molecular mimics could thus behave like antagonists to folic acid. These were precisely the antivitamins that Farber had been fantasizing about. Farber wrote to Kilty and Subbarao, asking them if he could use their folate antagonists on patients with leukemia. Subbarao consented. In the late summer of 1947, the first package of antifolate left Lederle's labs in New York and arrived in Farber's laboratory. Farber's gauntlet. Throughout the centuries, the sufferer from this disease has been the subject of almost every conceivable form of experimentation. The fields and forests, the apothecary shop and the temple have been ransacked for some successful means of relief from this intractable malady. Hardly any animal has escaped making its contribution, in hair or hide, tooth or toenail, thymus or thyroid, liver or spleen, in the vain search by man for a means of relief. William Bainbridge. The search for a way to eradicate this scourge is left to incidental dabbling and uncoordinated research. The Washington Post, 1946. 7 miles south of the Longwood Hospitals in Boston, the town of Dorchester is a typical sprawling New England suburb, a triangle wedged between the sooty industrial settlements to the west and the gray-green bays of the Atlantic to its east. In the late 1940s, waves of Jewish and Irish immigrants, shipbuilders, ironcasters, railway engineers, fishermen, and factory workers settled in Dorchester, occupying rows of brick and clapboard houses that snake their way up Blue Hill Avenue. Dorchester reinvented itself as the quintessential suburban family town, with parks and playgrounds along the river, a golf course, a church, and a synagogue. On Sunday afternoons, families converged at Franklin Park to walk through its leafy pathways or to watch ostriches, polar bears, and tigers at its zoo. On August 16th, 1947, in a house across from the zoo, the child of a shipworker in the Boston Yards fell mysteriously ill with a low-grade fever that waxed and waned over 2 weeks without pattern, followed by increasing lethargy and pallor. Robert Sandler was 2 years old. His twin, Elliot, was an active cherubic toddler in perfect health. 10 days after his first fever, Robert's condition worsened significantly. His temperature climbed higher. His complexion turned from rosy to a spectral milky white. He was brought to Children's Hospital in Boston. His spleen, a fist-size organ that stores and makes blood, usually barely palpable underneath the rib cage, was visibly enlarged, heaving down like an overfilled bag. A drop of blood under Farber's microscope revealed the identity of his illness. Thousands of immature lymphoid leukemic blasts were dividing in a frenzy, their chromosomes condensing and uncondensing like tiny clenched and unclenched fists. Sandler arrived at Children's Hospital just a few weeks after Farber had received his first package from Letterly. On September 6th, 1947, Farber began to inject Sandler with pteroyl aspartic acid, or PAA, the first of Letterly's antifolates. Consent to run a clinical trial for a drug, even a toxic drug, was not typically required. Parents were occasionally cursorily informed about the trial. Children were almost never informed or consulted. The Nuremberg Code for Human Experimentation, requiring explicit voluntary consent from patients, was drafted on August 9, 1947, less than a month before the PAA trial. It is doubtful that Farber in Boston had even heard of any such required consent code. PAA had little effect. Over the next month, Sandler turned increasingly lethargic. He developed a limp, the result of leukemia pressing down on his spinal cord. Joint aches appeared, and violent, migrating pains. Then the leukemia burst through one of the bones in his thigh, causing a fracture and unleashing a blindingly intense, indescribable pain. By December, the case seemed hopeless. The tip of Sandler's spleen, more dense than ever with leukemia cells, dropped down to his pelvis. He was withdrawn, listless, swollen, and pale, on the verge of death. On December 28th, however, Farber received a new version of antifolate from Subbarao and Kilty, eminopterin, a chemical with a small change from the structure of PAA. Farber snatched the drug as soon as it arrived and began to inject the boy with it, hoping, at best, for a minor reprieve in his cancer. The response was marked. The white cell count, which had been climbing astronomically, 10,000 in September, 20,000 in November, and nearly 70,000 in December, suddenly stopped rising and hovered at a plateau. Then, even more remarkably, the count actually started to drop. the leukemic blasts gradually flickering out in the blood and then all but disappearing. By New Year's Eve, the count had dropped to nearly one-sixth of its peak value, bottoming out at a nearly normal level. The cancer hadn't vanished. Under the microscope, there were still malignant white cells, but it had temporarily abated, frozen into a hematologic stalemate in the frozen Boston winter. On January 13, 1948, Sandler returned to the clinic, walking on his own for the first time in 2 months. His spleen and liver had shrunk so dramatically that his clothes, Farber noted, had become loose around the abdomen. His bleeding had stopped. His appetite turned ravenous, as if he were trying to catch up on 6 months of lost meals. By February, Farber noted, the child's alertness, nutrition, and activity were equal to his twins. For a brief month or so, Robert Sandler and Elliot Sandler seemed identical again. Sandler's remission, unprecedented in the history of leukemia, set off a flurry of activity for Farber. By the early winter of 1948, more children were at his clinic. A 3-year-old boy brought with a sore throat, a 2.5-year-old girl with lumps in her head and neck, all eventually diagnosed with childhood ALL. Deluged with antifolates from Yella and with patients who desperately needed them, Farber recruited additional doctors to help him, a hematologist named Louis Diamond, and a group of assistants, James Wolfe, Robert Mercer, and Robert Sylvester. Farber had infuriated the authorities at Children's Hospital with his first clinical trial. With this, the second, he pushed them over the edge. The hospital staff voted to take all the pediatric interns off the leukemia chemotherapy unit. The atmosphere in the leukemia wards, it was felt, was far too desperate and experimental, and thus not conducive to medical education. In essence, leaving Farber and his assistants to perform all the patient care themselves. Children with cancer, as one surgeon noted, were typically tucked in the farthest recesses of the hospital wards. They were on their deathbeds anyway, the pediatricians argued. Wouldn't it be kindler and gentler, some insisted, to just let them die in peace? When one clinician suggested that Farber's novel chemicals be reserved only as a last resort for leukemic children, Farber, recalling his prior life as a pathologist, shot back, "By that time, the only chemical that you will need will be embalming fluid." Farber outfitted a back room of a ward near the bathrooms into a makeshift clinic. His small staff was housed in various unused spaces in the Department of Pathology, in back rooms, stairwell shafts, and empty offices. Institutional support was minimal. Farber's assistants sharpened their own bone marrow needles, a practice as antiquated as a surgeon whetting his knives on a wheel. Farber's staff tracked the disease in patients with meticulous attention to detail. Every blood count, every transfusion, every fever was to be recorded. If leukemia was going to be beaten, Farber wanted every minute of that battle recorded for posterity, even if no one else was willing to watch it happen. That winter of 1948, a severe and dismal chill descended on Boston. Snowstorms broke out, bringing Farber's clinic to a standstill. The narrow asphalt road out to Longwood Avenue was piled with heaps of muddy sleet, and the basement tunnels, poorly heated even in the fall, were now freezing. Daily injections of antifolates became impossible, and Farber's team backed down to 3 times a week. In February, when the storms abated, the daily injections started again. Meanwhile, news of Farber's experience with childhood leukemia was beginning to spread, and a slow train of children began to arrive at his clinic. And case by case, an incredible pattern emerged. The antifolates could drive leukemia cell counts down, occasionally even resulting in their complete disappearance, at least for a while. There were other remissions as dramatic as Sandler's. 2 boys treated with aminopterin returned to school. Another child, a 2.5-year-old girl, started to play and run about after 7 months of lying in bed. The normalcy of blood almost restored a flickering, momentary normalcy to the childhood. But there was always the same catch. After a few months of remission, the cancer would inevitably relapse, ultimately flinging aside even the most potent of Yella's drugs. The cells would return in the bone marrow, then burst out into the blood, and even the most active antifolates would not keep their growth down. Robert Sandler died in 1948, having responded for a few months. Yet the remissions, even if temporary, were still genuine remissions, and historic. By April 1948, there was just enough data to put together a preliminary paper for the New England Journal of Medicine. The team had treated 16 patients. Of the 16, 10 had responded, and 5 children, about one-third of the initial group, remained alive 4 or even 6 months after their diagnosis. In leukemia, 6 months of survival was an eternity. Farber's paper, published on June 3, 1948, was 7 pages long, jam-packed with tables, figures, microscope photographs, laboratory values, and blood counts. Its language was starched, formal, detached, and scientific. Yet, like all great medical papers, it was a page-turner. And like all good novels, it was timeless. To read it today is to be pitched behind the scenes into the tumultuous life of the Boston Clinic, its patients hanging on for life as Farber and his assistants scramble to find new drugs for a dreadful disease that kept flickering away and returning. It was a plot with a beginning, a middle, and unfortunately, an end. The paper was received, as one scientist recalls, with skepticism, disbelief, and outrage. But for Farber, the study carried a tantalizing message. Cancer, even in its most aggressive form, had been treated with a medicine, a chemical. In 6 months between 1947 and 1948, Farber thus saw a door open, briefly, seductively, then close tightly shut again. And through that doorway, he glimpsed an incandescent possibility. The disappearance of an aggressive systemic cancer via a chemical drug was virtually unprecedented in the history of cancer. In the summer of 1948, when one of Farber's assistants performed a bone marrow biopsy on a leukemic child after treatment with eminopterin, the assistant could not believe the results. "The bone marrow looked so normal," he wrote, "that one could dream of a cure." And so Farber did dream. He dreamed of malignant cells being killed by specific anti-cancer drugs, and of normal cells regenerating and reclaiming their physiological spaces, of a whole gamut of such systemic antagonists to decimate malignant cells, of curing leukemia with chemicals, then applying his experience with chemicals and leukemia to more common cancers. He was throwing down a gauntlet for cancer medicine. It was then up to an entire generation of doctors and scientists to pick it up. A private plague. We reveal ourselves in the metaphors we choose for depicting the cosmos in miniature. Stephen Jay Gould. Thus, for 3,000 years and more, this disease has been known to the medical profession. And for 3,000 years and more, humanity has been knocking at the door of the medical profession for a cure. Fortune, March 1937. Now it is cancer's turn to be the disease that doesn't knock before it enters. Susan Sontag, Illness as Metaphor. We tend to think of cancer as a modern illness because its metaphors are so modern. It is a disease of overproduction, of fulminant growth, growth unstoppable, growth tipped into the abyss of no control. Modern biology encourages us to imagine the cell as a molecular machine. Cancer is that machine unable to quench its initial command to grow, and thus transformed into an indestructible, self-propelled automaton. The notion of cancer as an affliction that belongs paradigmatically to the 20th century is reminiscent, as Susan Sontag argued so powerfully in her book Illness as Metaphor, of another disease once considered emblematic of another era, tuberculosis in the 19th century. Both diseases, as Sontag pointedly noted, were similarly obscene in the original meaning of that word, ill-omened, abominable, repugnant to the senses. Both drain vitality. Both stretch out the encounter with death. In both cases, dying, even more than death, defines the illness. But despite such parallels, tuberculosis belongs to another century. TB, or consumption, was Victorian Romanticism brought to its pathological extreme, febrile, unrelenting, breathless, and obsessive. It was a disease of poets, John Keats involuting silently toward death in a small room overlooking the Spanish Steps in Rome, or Byron, an obsessive romantic, who fantasized about dying of the disease to impress his mistresses. Death and disease are often beautiful, like the hectic glow of consumption, Thoreau wrote in 1852. In Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, this hectic glow releases a feverish creative force in its victims, a clarifying, edifying, cathartic force that, too, appears to be charged with the essence of its era. Cancer, in contrast, is riddled with more contemporary images. The cancer cell is a desperate individualist in every possible sense, a nonconformist, as the surgeon writer Sherwin Newland wrote. The word metastasis, used to describe the migration of cancer from one site to another, is a curious mix of meta and stasis, beyond stillness in Latin, an unmoored, partially unstable state that captures the peculiar instability of modernity. If consumption once killed its victims by pathological evisceration, the tuberculosis bacillus gradually hollows out the lung, then cancer asphyxiates us by filling bodies with too many cells. It is consumption in its alternate meaning, the pathology of excess. Cancer is an expansionist disease. It invades through tissues, sets up colonies in hostile landscapes, seeking sanctuary in one organ and then immigrating to another. It lives desperately, inventively, fiercely, territorially, cannily, and defensively, at times as if teaching us how to survive. To confront cancer is to encounter a parallel species, one perhaps more adapted to survival than even we are. This image of cancer as our desperate, malevolent, contemporary doppelganger is so haunting because it is at least partly true. A cancer cell is an astonishing perversion of the normal cell. Cancer is a phenomenally successful invader and colonizer in part because it exploits the very features that make us successful as a species or as an organism. Like the normal cell, the cancer cell relies on growth in the most basic, elemental sense, the division of one cell to form two. In normal tissues, this process is exquisitely regulated, such that growth is stimulated by specific signals and arrested by other signals. In cancer, unbridled growth gives rise to generation upon generation of cells. Biologists use the term clone to describe cells that share a common genetic ancestor. Cancer, we now know, is a clonal disease. Nearly every known cancer originates from one ancestral cell that, having acquired the capacity of limitless cell division and survival, gives rise to limitless numbers of descendants. Virchow's Omnis cellula et cellula et cellula, repeated ad infinitum. But cancer is not simply a clonal disease, it is a clonally evolving disease. If growth occurred without evolution, cancer cells would not be imbued with their potent capacity to invade, survive, and metastasize. Every generation of cancer cells creates a small number of cells that is genetically different from its parents. When a chemotherapeutic drug, or the immune system, attacks cancer, mutant clones that can resist the attack grow out. The fittest cancer cell survives. This mirthless, relentless cycle of mutation, selection, and overgrowth generates cells that are more and more adapted to survival and growth. In some cases, the mutations speed up the acquisition of other mutations. The genetic instability, like a perfect madness, only provides more impetus to generate mutant clones. Cancer thus exploits the fundamental logic of evolution, unlike any other illness. If we as a species are the ultimate product of Darwinian selection, then so too is this incredible disease that lurks inside us. Such metaphorical seductions can carry us away, but they are unavoidable with a subject like cancer. In writing this book, I started off by imagining my project as a history of cancer. But it felt inescapably as if I were writing not about something, but about someone. My subject daily morphed into something that resembled an individual, an enigmatic, if somewhat deranged, image in a mirror. This was not so much a medical history of an illness, but something more personal, more visceral. Its biography. So to begin again, for every biographer must confront the birth of his subject, where was cancer born? How old is cancer? Who was the first to record it as an illness? In 1862, Edwin Smith, an unusual character, part scholar and part huckster, an antique forger and self-made Egyptologist, bought, or some say stole, a 15-long papyrus from an antique seller in Luxor in Egypt. The papyrus was in dreadful condition, with crumbling yellow pages filled with cursive Egyptian script. It is now thought to have been written in the 17th century BC, a transcription of a manuscript dating back to 2500 BC. The copier, a plagiarist in a terrible hurry, had made errors as he had scribbled, often noting corrections in red ink in the margins. Translated in 1930, the papyrus is now thought to contain the collected teachings of Imhotep, a great Egyptian physician who lived around 2625 BC. Imhotep, among the few non-royal Egyptians known to us from the Old Kingdom, was a Renaissance man at the center of a sweeping Egyptian Renaissance. As a vizier in the court of King Djoser, he dabbled in neurosurgery, tried his hand at architecture, and made early forays into astrology and astronomy. Even the Greeks, encountering the fierce, hot blast of his intellect as they marched through Egypt centuries later, cast him as an ancient magician and fused him to their own medical god, Asclepius. But the surprising feature of the Smith Papyrus is not magic and religion, but the absence of magic and religion. In a world immersed in spells, incantations, and charms, Imhotep wrote about broken bones and dislocated vertebrae with a detached, sterile scientific vocabulary, as if he were writing a modern surgical textbook. The 48 cases in the papyrus, fractures of the hand, gaping abscesses of the skin, or shattered skull bones, are treated as medical conditions rather than occult phenomena, each with its own anatomical glossary, diagnosis, summary, and prognosis. And it is under these clarifying headlamps of an ancient surgeon that cancer first emerges as a distinct disease. Describing case 45, Imhotep advises, "If you examine a case having bulging masses on the breast, and you find that they have spread over his breast, if you place your hand upon the breast and find them to be cool, there being no fever at all therein when your hand feels him, they have no granulations, contain no fluid, give rise to no liquid discharge, yet they feel protuberant to your touch, you should say concerning him, 'This is a case of bulging masses I have to contend with.' Bulging tumors of the breast mean the existence of swellings on the breast, large, spreading, and hard. Touching them is like touching a ball of wrappings. or they may be compared to the unripe hemat fruit, which is hard and cool to the touch. A bulging mass in the breast, cool, hard, dense as a hemat fruit, and spreading insidiously under the skin, could hardly be a more vivid description of breast cancer. Every case in the papyrus was followed by a concise discussion of treatments, even if only palliative. Milk poured through the ears of neurosurgical patients, poultices for wounds, balms for burns. But with case 45, Imhotep fell atypically silent. Under the section titled Therapy, he offered only a single sentence. There is none. With that admission of impotence, cancer virtually disappeared from ancient medical history. Other diseases cycled violently through the globe, leaving behind their cryptic footprints in legends and documents. A furious febrile plague, typhus perhaps, blazed through the port city of Avaris in 1715 BC, decimating its population. Smallpox erupted volcanically in pockets, leaving its telltale pockmarks on the face of Ramses V in the 12th century BC. Tuberculosis rose and ebbed through the Indus Valley like its seasonal floods. But if cancer existed in the interstices of these massive epidemics, it existed in silence, leaving no easily identifiable trace in the medical literature, or in any other literature. More than two millennia pass after Imhotep's description until we once more hear of cancer. And again, it is an illness cloaked in silence, a private shame. In his sprawling Histories, written around 440 BC, the Greek historian Herodotus records the story of Atossa, the queen of Persia, who was suddenly struck by an unusual illness. Atossa was the daughter of Cyrus and the wife of Darius, successive Achaemenid emperors of legendary brutality who ruled over a vast stretch of land from Lydia on the Mediterranean Sea to Babylonia on the Persian Gulf. In the middle of her reign, Atossa noticed a bleeding lump in her breast that may have arisen from a particularly malevolent form of breast cancer labeled inflammatory. In inflammatory breast cancer, malignant cells invade the lymph glands of the breast, causing a red, swollen mass. If Atossa had desired it, an entire retinue of physicians from Babylonia to Greece would have flocked to her bedside to treat her. Instead, she descended into a fierce and impenetrable loneliness. She wrapped herself in sheets in a self-imposed quarantine. Darius's doctors may have tried to treat her, but to no avail. Ultimately, a Greek slave named Demosides persuaded her to allow him to excise the tumor. Soon after that operation, Atossa mysteriously vanishes from Herodotus's text. For him, she is merely a minor plot twist. We don't know whether the tumor recurred or how or when she died. But the procedure was at least a temporary success. Atossa lived, and she had Demosthenes to thank for it. And that reprieve from pain and illness whipped her into a frenzy of gratitude and territorial ambition. Darius had been planning a campaign against Scythia on the eastern border of his empire. Goaded by Demosthenes, who wanted to return to his native Greece, Atossa pleaded with her husband to turn his campaign westward, to invade Greece. That turn of the Persian Empire from east to west, and the series of Greco-Persian wars that followed, would mark one of the definitive moments in the early history of the West. It was Atossa's tumor, then, that quietly launched 1,000 ships. Cancer, even as a clandestine illness, left its fingerprints on the ancient world. But Herodotus and Imhotep are storytellers, and like all stories, theirs have gaps and inconsistencies. The cancers described by them may have been true neoplasms, or perhaps they were hazily describing abscesses, ulcers, warts, or moles. The only incontrovertible cases of cancer in history are those in which the malignant tissue has somehow been preserved. And to encounter one such cancer face to face, to actually stare the ancient illness in its eye, one needs to journey to a 1,000-year-old gravesite in a remote, sand-swept plain in the southern tip of Peru. The plain lies at the northern edge of the Atacama Desert.